Welcome back to Finding the Edge podcast. I'm Garrett Boyum, joined with Robert Fry.
And today we're going to talk about some of the anomalies with projections and some guys who outperformed them this past season. And, you know, just seeing like what can we deduct or deduce, I should say, what can we deduce from those guys and how they were able to outperform those projections.
And one of the guys that I wanted to really look at, or I think we're going to start the conversation with, is Cody Bellinger. Because it's just been fun for me to watch him this year because I've seen more adjustability from him that's functional. And so that's kind of, I guess, where, at least for me, started my following him. And then it turns out he had a really great year. I just remember seeing a couple of swings. And I'm like, ooh, that kind of fits the Caleb Abney model of breaking the rules, doing things. And so I guess today I wanted to kind of look at some of that because I wanted to see, you know, looking at StatCast, what some of his expected stats were. Let's begin. You know, and it was kind of interesting to me just looking at some of this stuff, like expected weighted on base, generally speaking, not for everybody, but for a lot of guys, it ended up matching pretty close to, like their batting average in some ways. They must be fairly correlated.
Yeah. For the most part, they seem correlated. And then obviously there's some things. So like in recent years, as of 2019, StatCast decided to change its exit velocity formula. So from 2015 to 2018, it was just essentially exit velocity and launch angle, those two variables. However, from 2019 to present, they also incorporated a batter seasonal sprint speed. So that way they can adjust for different speeds, because if a topped or a weakly hit ground ball is hit, you know, a runner like Corbin Carroll, NL Rookie of the Year, is more likely to get a hit on those plays, whereas a bigger player like, say, Pablo Sandoval is not. It might be where a situation where, or we can think of a more recent player, because I'm not sure if Sandoval played this past season, but we can think of a guy like Franmil Reyes, somewhere along those lines, or like a Miguel Sano, since we're, you know, on that topic. Like, he's a bigger guy, so he's comparing, like, Sano to Corbin Carroll. You know, Sano is probably more likely to hit the ball harder, but for those weakly hit balls or topped balls, per StatCast's kind of barrel classification, Corbin Carroll is more likely to beat those out. So they felt like that should have been factored as well. So that's why I think in recent years, it's starting to get more and more detailed towards, you know, a runner speed rather than just hitting the ball hard.
Well, and then for me, you know, going back to Bellinger, that was something that clearly came up when I was looking at the dexterity of his hitting ability. There were some balls that became hits simply because of his speed. For other guys, those would have been outs. The other element of it too, not that Bellinger is slow, but he's also left-handed, right? So the speed that he has gets a little boost just by the sheer fact that he's left-handed. So then again, somebody, a right-hander with the same speed might not end up being able to be safe on some of those. There's other things that too, though, like, cause Luis Arraez is not that fast. And there are a couple of hits that they gave him at least early in the season that there's a hard ground ball to second or whatever, guy bobbled it, threw it and he was safe. Oh, he threw it. It bounced. And then the first baseman didn't field it or catch it. And he was safe, but it wasn't because the ball had bounced and he caught it, he would have been out. So to me, that's an error, and I don't know why they classified it as a hit, because he was going to be out if if the first baseman had actually caught the ball instead of missing it. So there are small things like that, but there are other little things like Luis Arraez, again, not being, I don't know where he ranks in the sprint speed, but it's not elite by any means, as far as I can tell. He's not known as being extremely famous.
Per Baseball Savant's sprint speed leaderboard of players without at least 100 competitive rounds, i.e., you know, whether or not jogging, things like that, competitive rounds. Cody Bellinger is 72nd. Luis Arraez is 235th. The average sprint speed in the MLB is 27 feet per second.
Yeah.
Luis Arraez was slightly below average at 26.1 feet per second. And Cody Bellinger was above average at 28.3 feet per second.
And that's where I think it's kind of interesting to me that Arraez is still able to beat out some of those infield hits. But I think that, like, I remember reading a long time ago, I think in one of the strength and conditioning books that I found for baseball, that everybody is fast. Like, there's a minimum speed that a guy needs to be able to play at in professional baseball in order to get enough hits, even the big guys. So even the big guys are relatively fast, because if not, they would not be able to hit at a high or get on base enough if they were too slow. And so even the slow guys can get down the line fast enough to beat out certain infield singles. And so I think that to me is how I explain, well, Luis Arraez isn't that fast, yet he hits some balls in the infield that go straight to fielders, and then he's somehow able to be safe. So to me, that says he's not that slow. But I think that's just a we're talking about a relative, right? When we're trying to compare players, right? That's where this factors in. But at the same point, I think we all have to recognize that, you know, every guy who plays in MLB baseball, like, unless you're probably at the bottom of the barrel, like, you're probably fast enough. But to your point, because ex-WOBA for Luis Arraez came in at 353, and his batting average was 354. So I thought that was pretty cool to see, like, how close those two things got to each other. I mean, his expecting batting average, he outperformed his expecting batting average. You know, going back to, you know, the expected stats, I thought that was kind of interesting. Like, I don't know how accurate expected batting average actually is relative to what guys usually end up at. And so I don't see, this is kind of the thing with, like, the expected stats, like, how much do you sit there and go, oh, well, he overperformed. And it's like, well, I don't really think so. Like, if you look at, if we're just talking about Arraez and what I watched, if you look at the launch angle that he created, it gave him the greatest opportunity to get a lot of those hits. And then, you know, I was watching too, it said when they were playing the Twins, they tried to pitch him up and in, but you could see that this year he hit a lot of those balls that were up well enough for hits. Like, I want to say I saw multiple, and I didn't get to watch all of his hits, but I saw, you know, at least five balls up in the zone that he hit well, fastballs too. So, I mean, nothing that was like super high velocity, high spin, but still the fact that he's able to get to those pitches tells me that this dude is super hard to pitch to, because especially early in the year, I didn't get to watch it later in the year, but early in the year, they were hitting him with a lot of fastballs. Yeah. So anyways, I'm going to repeat that just for the, because I got a stupid noise that popped up in there. Early in the year, Luis Arraez got a lot of fastballs. He was hitting a lot of fastballs. He did start to see more breaking balls, I think, later in the year, but early in the year, he was seeing a lot of fastballs and hitting the fastball. So I thought that was kind of interesting to note when it came to like how, what is he getting his hits on? And I think that's another question to ask too, especially if we're trying to look at, okay, how from an ecological perspective, how dexterous is a player? I think dexterity is probably how masterful. I'm trying to figure out another word for people who aren't as familiar with, like, what's dexterity, right? The ability to display, I'm going to say it this way, the ability to display functional solutions, under a myriad of different conditions. So he's able to have success under a wide range of conditions, meaning, okay, so he can handle the fastball, but okay, what type of fastball, right? Is it middle? Is it away? Is it up? Like, is there certain areas that he struggles with? Arise seems to display that he can handle a large range of fastballs, but not only fastballs, but breaking balls. This is the same thing too with Bellinger. I saw it more with Bellinger because he got more breaking balls a lot. There were, of the video clip that I put up, I think it was about 14 of those, or of like showing his adjustability in his swing. He got 14 hits in 2K counts and 2-strike counts. And a lot of those were breaking balls, not all of them, but a lot of them were breaking balls. And that to me says quite a bit as far as your ability and what you can do on the field. And that makes you a dangerous and a potent hitter. And then I think that's part of what allowed him to be the comeback player of the year.
Absolutely. I mean, another way to look at it too is, like you said, you know, 14 hits with 2-strike counts. Like, and we go back to like ex Woba versus Woba. So, like, according to Baseball Savant, his ex Woba was 327. His Woba was 370. So, like, he significantly outperformed his expected Woba. And a lot of it was, you know, middle pitches. So, again, on Baseball Savant, his ex-Woba on pitches middle away, 412, middle, 379, middle in, 341. However, he performed 475 middle away, 520 middle, 445 middle in. And a lot of that, too, is like you said, like he had so many 2-strike hits. I think part of it, like you said, with his dexterity for Arias, but similar with Cody Bellinger, is being able to be, you know, adaptable and attuned to the specifying information of, okay, I'm likely getting a breaking ball here. I don't have to put an aggressive swing on it. I need to put a swing that is likely to result in a hit or a swing that allows me just to put the ball in play.
I think for me, you know, I'm gonna bristle a little bit at the whole anticipation. Not that I think guys don't anticipate, but I think it's hard unless, I mean, there is enough at the professional level to know guys' tendencies, to have a good idea what's going to be thrown here. But I think a lot of it can be handled by simply changing your approach. So, you know, if you shift your intention and you have an approach of, okay, I'm in a 2-strike, you know, I'm going to take a 2-strike approach, meaning, okay, I'm not going to try to swing out of my shoes. For me, the way that I think of a 2-strike approach is I liken it to a hit and run, but a hit and run where you don't have to swing. But the intention is I'm going to try to stay on this ball and, like, because to me, that's what it looks like, is he's staying on the ball and he's being smooth and he's not trying to hit it as hard as he can. He's just trying to go bat to ball and just be really smooth and move however he has to be able to hit the baseball. And so that's where, for me, when I'm looking at it, and just even too, this is where I like Luis Arraez, and I wanted to look and I haven't gotten there yet, but at some point I want to get through, you know, all of Acuna and like all the guys that hit really well this year at the top and just watch, you know, how they went about it. Cause I think every guy is different, but anyways, the conclusion that I've come to based upon these two guys, Bellinger and Arise, is that, and this is why I really like Bellinger, is that if you can hit a rising line drive within a good launch angle, and by a rising line drive, I mean one that clears the infielders. Like, if they jump, it's either really hard for them to catch it or they can't catch it at all. And so if you can do that, then you're going to give yourself a really good chance to get on base as far as like hitting the ball. And when I think about it, and as far as what was popular, and I don't know if it's still popular. I think it's still there, but it's not as popular, of the whole notion of try to hit the ball in the air and as far as you can. And then we're kind of at one point, right? Cause MLB is trying to change this and not have the game be just three true outcomes of, you know, hit the ball out of the park, strike out, or I don't know, walk. I can't remember. Is that, what was the third one of the three true outcomes? Was it basically like home run, strikeout, or what was the third
walk,
one? Do you remember?
Walk slash hit by pitch.
Yeah. Right. And so this is where, you know, and I've also heard this too, of listening to some other guys talk about like, okay, if we strike out at too high of a clip, even though we're hitting a bunch of home runs, we start to hurt our run value, you know? And so there's a level of like, there's value. And this is why it was cool. Arise was very interesting. Cause if you start looking at his stat line, now I don't think this year his runs were down relative to with the Twins. No, it doesn't have RBIs on here. The one that I'm looking at. Do you have RBIs on your stats? Yeah.
For Rams, he had 69 RBIs.
Nice. How much do you have for 2022?
He had 49.
Okay, so he had more RBIs this year than he did last year. Okay, because to me, part of the value of a player now, yes, it all depends upon where you are in the lineup and who's on base, but it's a question of given the number of opportunities that you have, how well are you able to capitalize on those opportunities? I don't know if there's a stat for that. I mean, there's probably runners in batting average and runners in scoring position, right? Because that would kind of probably capture that. But like, to me, these are the things that matter.
I want to say another way you could capture is win probability added.
Okay. Because that's where it's like, you know, a guy like Luis Arraez, I think what people sleep on because of the fact that he doesn't hit for power. He doesn't really slug, you know? And they're like, you know, singles aren't really that worth it. But it's like, it depends. It depends, right? You know, everybody's big on like on base. Well, you know, singles are they're not that much different than a walk, but you know, and a walk is a sure thing, but still at the same point, you're still on base. And if you got a guy in scoring position and a base open at first, a walk ain't going to score you that run, you know, or even two bases open. Like you need three walks in a row to get you a run. So like a hit, being able to put the ball in play and score the run is huge. Cause I mean, so that's where I look at. For me, when I look at a guy like Arise who hits for average, I want to look at his runs and his RBIs. Because to me, those two things combined together tell me how much offensive production, like, is it just, you know, he hits really well when nobody's on base and, you know, like, it's just, you're not really contributing that much. You only hit when there's no pressure. But if you're scoring enough runs for the team, then I think it washes that whole, you know, I guess, you know, at one point the new school analytic way of looking at it of, you know, average is kind of not really that valuable. And I think there's some level of truth to it, but I don't think you can completely dismiss looking at batting average.
Yeah, but there's also that side of, okay, if you want to look at production in terms of runs and RBIs, those are both context dependent. Because mm-hmm. for you to score runs, you need that are not home run related, right? You need guys behind you to be able to put the ball in play and move you around. And then for you to have RBIs on the same breath, you need the guys in front of you to get on base. So that's why there's kind of this disconnect, because it is dependent. Whereas, you know, some analytics just say, like, we can't rely on that dependency.
Well, here's my thought on how you kind of you do the analysis. Because I look at the Twins, okay? And so the Twins last year, their offense probably wasn't the highest scoring in baseball, right? But you look at it relative, okay? So when I looked at the team last year, I looked at, okay, where were all our runs coming from, right? Even though Luis Arraez's numbers in runs, actually a little bit higher in 2022, and then his RBIs were a little bit lower, right? So that says that when Arise was hitting, there weren't as many opportunities for him to hit guys in, but he was, if he was getting on base, he was scoring at a decent clip, higher clip than he was in 2023, you know? And so this is where I look at it in the sense of relative. He was the top. He was the one that was scoring the most runs for the team, and Correa was second, or Correa was first, and then Arise was right behind him. So when you look at it relative to just your team, because that's the context that matters, and you begin to see for that team, who is the one for your team that's scoring all your runs? Who's the one who's driving them all in? And that to me is a fair enough analysis of it's, you can't start comparing across the league or whatever, because to your point, it's context dependent. So therefore you have to look at it within the context that these numbers actually occur. And then I think you can get a better sense of how much value can a player provide in a team setting.
And so there's other stats we can look at too. So like runs mm-hmm. created is a good one that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So like, mm-hmm. and that does include, you know, scoring runs as well, not just creating runs by hitting, but scoring. Another
one. Do you want to flesh that out a little bit more of like what goes into runs created? What makes up, how do we come up with that number?
Yeah. So like we can do it. There's actually like a few different ways to calculate it. And this was from Bill James. So like the most simplest way is hits plus walks multiplied by total bases divided by at bats plus walks. And that is the most simplest way of calculating. Now, if you want to get into more advanced stuff, so like there's a stolen base version of it where multiplies by a stolen base factor. And then the technical one is multiplying by a factor of walks plus hit by pitches plus the times you have sack bunts, sacrifice flies, stolen bases. And then it also negatively weights you for hitting into double plays as well. Because
does that influence like somebody like Correa? Because I felt like he hit into a decent number of.
Yeah, so like that would negatively affect him on that version. Another way to look at it, and you're gonna like this because the two people we're talking about, Arias, 14th in the MLB last year amongst qualified hitters, Bellinger, 15th in the MLB last year amongst qualified hitters, and weighted runs above average, and that is based on WOBA. So it's taking that player's individual WOBA, subtracting from the league WOBA. So Bellinger's was around 370. The league WOBA's around 320. So he gets 50 points boost. And then the WOBA scale, which just essentially is putting it on the same scale as OBP. So it could be read like OBP. And then multiplying by the number of PAs. And so it just basically just measures the amount of offensive runs a player contributes to their team compared to the average player. And with that being said, so Arias, 25.9 weighted runs above average. Cody Bellinger, 23.9 weighted runs above average. Again, 14th and 15th. And
okay, who is above them? Can you shoot me a thing that has this list, or just share screen it? Because I don't, like, part of me, I'm curious who's up there higher than that. I mean, look, Ronald Acuna Jr.
Like
Acuna, 150 runs, almost 150 runs all on his own. Oh my gosh. That's a lot.
Acuna is number one.
Okay.
As he should be at 66.7. Otani is number two at 57.3. And I shared this with you. Betts is third. Mookie Betts is third, 56.5. But another way to think about this too, the top two players in the, or I should say the top players in their respective leagues in WRAA won MVP. Acuna in the National League, Otani in the American League. Mookie Betts was 56.5, Matt Olson 56.4, Freddie Freeman, Juan Soto, Corey Seager, Yandy Diaz, Marcell Ozuna, Kyle Tucker, Bryce Harper, Corbin Carroll, and Austin Riley are the 13 names above both Arias and Bellinger.
That's
not a light list.
No. Okay. So let's talk about Juan Soto. I think Juan Soto. And I guess to Ozuna, could be one. Although the slug there makes sense for, because I'm one. Yep, slug there is decent. So I'm trying to figure out where is all this run production coming from? Is some okay? So his OPS is 930. So that's part of it, right? Getting on base. His OPS is 900 or 905. So this is where I'm trying to understand. Okay, how are they creating this run value? Because to me, what's interesting is that there's multiple different ways. You see a lot of guys with higher averages, but you know, Ozuna and Soto, they kind of are on the lower end of the average side. You know, because it felt like Soto kind of struggled this year, like swinging the bat. You know, his walks were always there, but swinging the bat, making contact was a down year for him. Or doing something, hitting it well enough to get hits. And so I guess what is your assessment as far as like, okay, how are they still, despite the fact of not doing as much with the bat as in other years, how are they still creating run value?
So in Soto's case, I feel like you said, the walks are always there. So he's still getting on base via walks. And like,
also the speed ain't super, super crazy either.
Yeah,
so terribly slow, but
so like having guys like Machado and Cronenworth, I think, behind him, you know, that helped with you know, the run production for him, just getting solely on base. Ozuna, in his case, I think he had, and this is where like we can maybe build on this stat and say, like, how many opportunities did Ozuna have compared to the average player of runners on base? Because Ozuna was very likely to have guys like Acuna, Matt Olson, Austin Riley, guys in the top 13 of this list on base ahead of him to be able to drive in these runs.
So now that to me, it plays into, okay, if we're talking about, okay, all right, do I want a guy like Ozuna? You know, how valuable will he be to this ball club if I don't have guys who can get on base in front of him? Like, it's not that he won't be valuable, but you're not going to see, he's not going to create as many runs for us because there's not going to be as many opportunities. Because I almost feel like in some of these things, whereas like a guy like Arraez, he can create opportunities because he's going to get on base enough, right? For people to drive him in. Whereas, you know, like you're talking about, like, I wonder if there's a way to parse through the numbers of like, okay, this guy really, his big upside is if we have guys on, he's really good at driving them in. But on the flip side, if he's not getting on base enough and there's not enough people to get on in front of him, his offensive value isn't as strong for our team. Like, our team needs other pieces in order to support what this hitter actually brings to the table.
All right. And so another way to look at it, I know I was trying to pull it up, but like, I remember going back to 2013 when the Cardinals made the World Series. Someone who wasn't really known as a great hitter on his own, Alan Craig. That year he had, I don't know the exact number, but I remember at some point in the season, he was hitting over 400 with runners in scoring position. And it's like that alone can make him valuable. But then again, like, okay, after the season, he was traded, went to Boston, and like, he didn't have as many opportunities, and that kind of like led to his downfall, so to speak. But he, you know, took advantage of opportunities when there were runners on base, specifically in scoring position.
He liked those affordances because there are different affordances with runners on base than when there aren't.
And maybe, like, you know, the thought process could change. It's like, hey, you know, like, it's common knowledge. I wouldn't say common knowledge, but for the most part, pitchers are less likely to throw breaking balls in the dirt with a runner on third base. Maybe in Craig's mind, you know, with a runner on third, he's like, I know I'm not getting a breaking ball.
battery going to hang it. He's going to hang it. Breaking balls to hit.
Or better break balls to hit. And as like a major league player, like, you know, you're going to hit that and hit that well.
I mean, too, there's some of it too of like, and this is where I think it's, you can kind of still find it in the analysis, right? Just without seeing video. But there are some guys, right, that they just hit certain balls better. It has to be in terms of location, right? Some guys' swings naturally work better with breaking balls. Like, it just, the ball just seems to go right into their swing. And so usually, though, it, from my experience of seeing those, like, that's, those are balls that are just like kind of in the middle of the zone. You know, it, and so whether it's like middle away or whatever, it's still, those balls just kind of fall right into their swing path. And so to your point, I think there is something to be said about it. Like, if you got a guy on third, less than two outs, or whatever, even with two outs, like getting a breaking ball that's up is a much more hittable pitch that guys can do something with. So, yeah. Anyways, I think that's a good observation.
Yeah, I mean, it just depends on how many opportunities you get. Like with Craig, he had, especially in 2011, he had the affordance of having a guy like Albert Pujols ahead of him. And a guy who would frequently be on base, or he would, you know, hit for extra bases quite a bit, not including home runs, obviously, but having guys like that. And then you add in another guy like Matt Holliday, you know, patching those together. So like in Ozuna's case, you know, this is where we can kind of look at, go dig deeper in the data and say like, okay, he might be up here a lot, but how many opportunities did he have where there's runners on base slash in scoring position? Because again, he had guys like Austin Riley, Acuna, Matt Olson all in front of him, and they all were wildly successful this season with the bat.
The other thing too, I'm just looking at some of the other numbers here. What's interesting to me, okay, Corbin Carroll, you know, he was hitting over 300 at some points, I think. But his walk, right, BB percentage, that's walk rate, yeah?
Yep.
Okay, so his walk rate is kind of on the lower end of guys. And I think that's kind of interesting that he was still able to create the run value that he was, even though like he seemed more like a contact guy, like kind of like a Kwan. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name.
Yeah,
right.
Stephen Kwan from Cleveland.
Yeah. And, but I mean, Kwan did not have the same year this year that he did, you know, the other year. I don't know if it's because guys started figuring out how to pitch to him or if there's something else going on, maybe an injury or something like that. But it's kind of interesting to me. I think maybe he slugged at a decent percentage, so maybe he actually has more pop than Kwan.
Yeah.
You know, cause that was kind of the other thing that was kind of interesting to watch with Carroll is despite the kind of interesting nature to his swing, like there, it seemed a little like the ball had kind of come off his bat a little bit more. And I have to look at like, I wonder if you have another hard hit percentages in here. I wonder what his average exit velo was. Because it's got to be more than a rise, which is interesting to watch. A lot of a rise's hits, though, are like in the 92 to 96 range. So it's not like he's hitting it super soft. I mean, but at the same point, you're not seeing as many 100 balls over a hit over 100 from a rise.
Right. And we talked about in the past, like if you go on Savant and find like exit velo launch angles hit probabilities, a lot of them are in that kind of like middle to hard range with that launch angle that's slightly above the infield because you hit it hard enough to hit it over the infield at a high enough angle, but not hard enough that it stays up long enough for the outfield to come and catch it.
And but the other thing
that's
too,
a big difference for Arias compared to,
yes,
compared to others.
The one thing to note on that I've started to think about is that it's different at the young, at the lower levels. Okay. Because the outfielders don't play at the same depth, even in college. You know, if like, because I think sometimes, you know, as guys from, you know, being at a junior college, it depends what the opposing team thinks, you know, or like the types of players that they play against. Because like, obviously, if we're playing a team that has more powerful bats, we're going to play deeper. But like when I was at the D1 level, like a lot of our guys, especially down the in the corners, left field especially, but I even think too, probably a little bit in right field, like they're pretty standing pretty darn close to the warning track. You know what I mean? And so if you're standing pretty close to the warning track, there's a lot more of like that low line drive, even if you hit it hard, that's going to tend to fall in front of the outfielders. But if they're playing in more at like a standard high school depth, like those are going to get caught, you know? So that's where I think it's really interesting that to me, the ones are more like you would say the flare burners, those ones tend to always be safe. And that to me is where I think it's actually interesting to start looking at launch angle and exit velo of like, okay, what do you got to get to? Cause I have to go back and look for sure. But I mean, off of Rapsodo, it'll give you some interesting numbers sometimes of like, hey, we think this is a hit, you know, a ball hit at 66 with a launch angle of 36. You're like, okay, it's not great. That's not a great exit velo, and that's not a great launch angle, but it somehow combines to drop in there. And other times you're like, man, how did that only went to 56 or 274, and those are outs. And that's where I think it's very interesting to start, like our ability to gauge distance. This is why, again, going back to like the ecological approach, the thing that I draw away from that I think is really important that a lot of us forget when we start talking about analytics, is that the game is not played. The individual person does not see the world in numbers. You know, we're not walking around with Google Glass on our eyes and like, you know, with like the numbers always like on our eyes and we can see them and like gauge this, you know, that's not the human. We understand things in terms of how it relates to us in terms of distances, right? The whole, like, you know, why we're not on the imperial numbers, right? Are in feet. Right. We understand things in terms of how they relate to our body. They're in feet. And so like that to me is like the thing we have to remember, because that's for me, like, you know, I haven't, you can dial in to begin to understand, you know, numbers, but you know, this is where I think it'd be fun to begin to dial in. Okay. How far is this distance? You know, when I see a ball hit in the air, how far about did that actually go? Just by looking, because most dimensions on the field are pretty consistent, you know, even if we're talking about the outfield. Like, this is why, you know, for example, Rapsodo, the average, you know, they'll give you a home run if you hit it over 330 feet to any of the corners, because most of the corners on most fields are about 330 feet, right? And center field, they have it. I think Rapsodo has it maybe. No, they have it further than that. But like, you know, 400 feet is pretty standard to a center field. So if you hit it over 400 feet to center, like, you know, so there's all this stuff is fairly standardized. And then you can begin to start judging, okay, how far is too far? You know, like, do I need to change my launch angle? Do I need increase or decrease my exit velo? These things to me are more of this is the thing too. Hopefully at some point I can re-talk to Bobby Tewksbury, because this is the thing that I think he really cares a lot about, is like the strategy. Like, a lot of times we're going with this whole thing of like, let's just take one element and like, or one strategy, and let's just go all in on this strategy. You know, like, let's hit home runs, all in on this strategy, you know, whereas it's like, yeah, but this is a game where, why can't it be as intricate as far as strategy goes as some of the other sports, you know, which I think it is, and it can be. And we have in some ways sold some of the players short at times. And maybe it's because like our lack of coaching ability to be able to get more out of players, of like, we end up going for these simpler approaches, and maybe they worked at one time, you know, with the fly ball revolution, you know, I think that worked. That was really good for that moment in time. And the way that I'm going to analogize it is to strength and conditioning, right? If I want to help somebody like peak in terms of speed, I can do that really easily if they have been like, their programming has been really strength heavy focused. And then if I switch it to more speed strength, they're going to get a really great response and feel super fast and like powerful and quick, but it's all because of the setup. And I think that's kind of the same thing with like the fly ball revolution. Was everybody was focused on hitting like ground balls to the backside and low line drives and had really pushy swings, and the fly ball was demonized. And then the way that pitchers, you know, attacked hitters was a lot simpler too. And so all these things allowed for that to like that to be a really great strategy for that period of time. And like its effectiveness, I think because it's older, now people are developing counter strategies to that, you know, and some of it is just also the advancements in pitching too, and pitching development, you know, velocity and now pitch design, all these things have come about during that period of time. And so I think we need to be looking for, you know, trying to find that edge, you know, so to speak. And I think that's where, I don't know, this is just my rant, right? Of like why I'm going to encourage people like EcoD. And now hopefully this helps for the transition for what you're about to say too. And
yeah,
this came up in the Sport Movement Skill Conference, listening to some of the talks and whatnot, is how do we combine the analytics with like these ideas? And so like just that, hopefully that gives you a good door to add what you were going to say.
I mean, I think now we can just say like, I think it's a lot of conversation of, okay, you know, when we take a look at this movement solution or this type of style, like what are the results? So you asked earlier about Arias and Corbin Carroll's average launch angle or average exit velocity. And then I also look at average launch angle. So Carroll this past season was 90 miles an hour. Arias, 88 miles an hour. But what stood out from them compared to most everyone else is they had a slightly higher launch angle at 11 degrees.
Mm.
And so
now, who's everybody else? Like, who are you classifying? Just the rest of the league average? Like, what's?
Yeah, the rest of the league average.
So what's the league average launch angle?
It's right around 7.
Okay. So that's fairly significant. That's like what, four points higher?
Yeah, 4 degrees higher. Now, the difference between that is, okay, if you just took, let's say Arias hit the ball every single time, 88 degrees with a, or 88
in 11,
exit via 11 degree launch angle. Yep. He is, his WOBA is expected to be 612.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So
with a same thing with a 7 degree launch angle, it's 522. So it's a 100 point difference. Now we boost it up to 90. What Corbin Carroll's at 11 degrees, 641. So slightly better. But then if you drop it down to 7 degrees, it's 503. So they're still relatively good, but having that slightly higher launch angle and being able to hit in those exit velo ranges, because then once you get to the harder ones, like we'll look at 100. 100 is 881, but it's still the average being 7630 at 100 degrees. So it's a lot, you know, it's one thing to be able to hit the ball hard, but it's another thing to be able to hit it in a, I guess I should say, range that allows you to enhance your opportunities of a hit.
Well, and this is kind of the thing that I want to kind of ask you about is like, this is the part of like, okay, expected stats versus reality. Okay. So the expected stat for Corbin Carroll is better on the launch angle, the average launch angle and exit velocity than Arise. But their averages, the reality is vastly different. You have a guy, where don't I see Arise here? Oh, there he is at 14. Okay. You have Arise hitting 354, right? So because you're talking about expected batting average. Well, his Arise is expecting batting average is lower than
expected Carroll's. WOBA. not batting average.
Oh, Woba.
Woba.
Okay. Now, Woba, that's weighted on base, right? So
yes.
So that would include walks?
Well, it would technically it would be Woba on contact.
So that's like we're talking like doubles, triples. So you're looking at something that looks like the stat is more of a like a slugging like OPS type stat.
Yes, but
so I should analogize this closer to OPS than I should. Like what is this comparing to? Like give me a real stat. You know what I'm saying? Like actual production, real production. Like what do you compare Woba against? Like. Expected Woba versus actual Woba. Is there a Woba stat?
Yeah. I guess, yeah, it's next to weighted runs above average, but.
Oh, there we go. Okay. So you had, cause this is to me, the 370 and I mean, they're basically the same 369.
Yeah, and so, like, looking at it that way,
yeah, it kind of,
but you start to see that they kind of got their different ways, and this is, like, the importance.
Yes.
The importance of standard deviation.
Sure.
Because Corbin Carroll is more likely to hit balls harder and further, therefore improving his Woba by hitting, you know, especially in that ballpark in Phoenix, hitting triples and home runs, especially when you hit it to right center or even left center there. Like, you are very likely to be able, and with his speed, get to third. Whereas Arias, I guess Miami is a pretty big ballpark too, but he doesn't quite have the speed that Carroll does, but is still able to get more frequent hits with that more lower, I guess, with that launch angle and that exit velocity, because he's more, I guess another way to look at this is accuracy versus precision, right?
Mm-hmm.
Arias is more precise with that average exit velocity and average launch angle, whereas Corbin Carroll, he might be more accurate in the sense that he's hit basically, like, he might have some that are weakly hit. He might have some that are harder hit.
Well, I almost wonder too. I just think about it in terms of launch angle. Like, I want to say that, okay, just from watching Arias, he's so consistent in his launch angle. Whereas I think, like, the standard deviation, or the maybe that's not the right word, but like the variability. There's the word I'm looking for. The variability within Corbin Carroll's launch angle is greater than the variability within Arise. Arise is fairly consistent in his launch angle. Whereas I think Carroll is either way up, is more up here. And, like, you know what I mean? Cause an average, right? Carroll might have a ton of ground balls that bring his average down, and his launch angle might actually be higher, you know, balls in the air. Cause that might be also what you, I don't know, because part of it too, of like Arise hits enough ground balls where they're not. I think that's the other important thing too. Cause even looking at Bellinger, some of his ground balls would have been where a typical second baseman or shortstop would be playing, but because they still, this is where I like it. I like it a lot that guys still shift. They still shift in the infield. They just can't have as extreme shifts. And those shifts open up holes that create, because this is the thing I think, you know, I didn't like banning the idea of banning the shift, but they didn't completely ban the shift. And I think that's, it's about modifying the shift to create the most opportunities for hitters to hit. And I think what they did and how it's played out, I would say they did it correctly. They didn't over constrain it. They constrained it enough to afford more hits. And so that, I think, is a positive there. And so anyways, where I'm going with that is that sometimes some of these balls on the ground, when they're hitting it where they're not. And that is somewhat a skill, and that is somewhat a byproduct of how the opposing team is shifting. And so anyways, the to me, that's where I think it's interesting to look at some of the ground balls, because some of them are hit hard enough that affords them to be hits. And I've always wondered kind of about that, like, what's the minimum, right? If I want to shoot a ball through the four hole or into the four hole, how hard do I have to hit it for the second baseman or the first baseman not to be able to go get that ball? And from what I've seen, if you really truly get it in that hole correctly, I think you can get it as low. You can hit it as low as like in the 60s, like 64, 65. But I think on average, to be safe, 75 miles an hour is about minimum. Now, this is on an MLB field with short grass. I think that's the caveat. You know, if you're hitting a low EV ground ball to the four hole and you got longer grass, that means that the fielders have more time to get to that ball because it's moving slower, right? So I don't know that this transfers to a high school player or like a college player that is playing on a field with longer grass in the early spring. I want to put that caveat in there of like, you know, it exit velocity still matters and probably matters a little bit more at the lower ages because of the fact that the grass or your surface type is going to be more variable than it is in the professional. Like, I think you have to put that caveat, like there's so much more consistency in the playing surface at the pro level.
Right. And if you have a greater affordance of lower exit velocities if you play on a turf field, say, you know, mm-hmm. Toronto.
Yeah.
Toronto, you can basically bury the ball on the ground with a very soft hit, and you are having a greater likelihood of getting a hit, you know, based on the parameters that you have stated because of that fast turf infield.
And so that's where, at least, you know, I'm not like some where I think ground balls are evil. I think they're part of the repertoire, but you can't rely on them enough because the probabilities of them turning into hits, I think, are lower than say, for example, a rising line drive that the infielders can't catch. I mean, it just makes sense to me, you know, unless the outfielders are playing super shallow. But that's kind of the thing of like, it was super cool, I thought, that which made also no sense, that at one point they tried to play the odds with a rise and shifted, either brought a guy into the infield or shifted the outfielders all to one side and left right field open, you know, when they had like the winning run on, I don't know, second or third, and Arise just hits his typical prototypical line drive that probably would have went right to the right fielder and boom, game over, you know? So I think it's kind of one of those things though, too, like to go back to, you know, so everybody knows I'm not anti hit the ball hard, because if you look at Arise, a lot of his ground balls are like 90 plus. And those are hard for infielders to handle, even though it's not like the top end, you know, a velo. It's still, they're firm, and those firm ones, like there's something about it just even in my head of like, from a psychological standpoint, being on the receiving end of a ball that looks like it's coming at you hard makes it harder. Like your motor skills tend to freeze up a little bit more. Your degrees of freedom tend to freeze a little bit more as a result. So even though you dove for it and you probably could have actually have got it, oftentimes you don't get it because you're not as fluid enough to be able to actually move the glove where it should be. You're just moving because you're like, oh gosh. And so anyways, that's why I think hard hit balls in general are always still going to be, you know, relatively good. Not to say that I don't think there's sometimes it makes sense to hit it weakly to an infielder, because that is also a hard play, but the infielders also at times tend to also be fluid enough to make up for those, or that's a different element of that problem. But anyways, I digress. All right, Robert, is there anything else in particular that you want to cover that I haven't thrown out or fed to you, you know, as a created an affordance for you? There's a better way of saying, is there any affordance I haven't created for you for something that you wanted to talk about?
Ecological dynamics. No, I think we covered a lot of kind of blending, you know, how can we have analytics help explain kind of some of the approaches within ecological dynamics and ask those kinds of questions. Because, yeah, like, not all hitters are created equal here. And like, Arias consistently is that type of person where he's kind of the outlier, if you will. Where, like, based on, he doesn't hit the ball that hard compared to the other people in, you know, within 5 or 10 spots of him. But he's still up here in successful, you know, type of hitters. And so being able to discuss this and say, like, you know, you can have different blends of hitters and still be successful. And I think the most successful teams have that. They have guys who can do both. The guys who can hit for, who are mostly hitting for power, you know, mostly the three true outcome guys. They have some guys in the Arias category. They have some guys who are a little bit of both. But, you know, you should have, like, you shouldn't be a one-trick pony, if you will, on that. And so
I think, you know, to kind of talk about, okay, how does ecological dynamics, to be very specific and explicit here, of my thoughts on how to utilize analytics from an ecological approach, or how to bring those two together, is it's all about context. Okay. So you want to be asking the questions of, okay, use analytics to dig into, I mean, obviously this is what people already do, but I think we have to remember this of, okay, let's find out what this guy does well. Let's see if we can dig through the numbers to find out, like, okay, how are they doing this? Because I think a lot of times we try to use these analytical models of a certain type of player, and we try to shove everybody else into that model and compare them to this model. Whereas I think we need to also, and if not more so, be looking at and asking the questions, especially of the anomalies like Arise, and I'm sure there's other ones that we can point to, but like, understanding these other anomalies of, like, hey, this person also who breaks the model can still have success, and how can we find out, can they have success? Because to me, that's where I'm like, you know, I want to know different things of, like, okay, with Arise and these other guys, okay, what pitches are they hitting well? Where are they hitting them, right? These are all ecological questions in a way of, like, the context. You know, if you want to begin to understand a player's skill, because to me, that's what ecological dynamics is all about, is understanding skilled behavior. Okay. How do we begin to utilize the analytics to understand the skill of a player, and not in terms of, like, how do they do on this model of, like, swing decisions, or, you know, like, I don't know, like, you know, what's their OPS, whatever sort of model, you know, that I think a lot of people sometimes will have, and then certain guys get left out. Cause I mean, I think, right, if you're looking at, again, finding an edge, right, and finding, you know, kind of in a way that, like, I like listening to Kyle Bodie talk about, like, them finding undervalued players. Okay. If you want to be able to find undervalued players and have them come and be successful in contributing to your team, I think you have to be able to look outside your model for other things, you know, other things of, like, you know, again, like, the other adaptable players. Cause to me, adaptability is the whole thing of, like, yeah, some guys might say, for example, not everybody is going to do things the way that Cody Bellinger was able to do, but we don't have to have this rigid, like, everybody needs to fit into this model of hitting, you know, of, you know, completely balanced, you know, stay back, whatever, like, every swing looks exactly the same. You can have this model of, like, you can have both. And that's, I think, the big thing for me, like, what ecological dynamics does in that framework, in that perspective, in that worldview, is it frees me up to say that I don't have to have every guy look exactly the same. And I don't have to, you could say, have a cookie cutter program that everybody's trying to fit into. That we can individualize it to the person. And then how I look at it as far as my role as a coach is, it's like, how can I find and look at the vast, you could say, library of players throughout history and how they've done things, and how can I find those different pieces of how they've found success and take those pieces and apply it to the player and find the right fit, you know, finding that element that another player's done well that fits with this current player that's in front of me so they can find success. And so for me, the ecological approach is such a powerful tool and a lens by which, in a filter, you could say, to help me look through the history, the vast history of the game, you know, from the past to the present, to help whatever player is sitting in front of me right now. So I hopefully that helps people kind of begin to see a little bit how these things come together and how, like, the power of the ecological approach. And obviously we need to get into more in the future of, like, what is the ecological approach? What are all these little principles and all that sort of stuff? But hopefully that's a good way to kind of wrap and help tie this all together. 100%. Anything you want to close with?
No, I think you closed it very, very well.
All right. Well, hope you guys enjoyed today's podcast and got something out of it. Until next time.
Until next time.